Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 21 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet Jane Draycott considers our inner travelling companions, and the travel writer and novelist Miranda France examines the challenge of finding one's voice. First, here's Jane Draycott with Travelling Companions.
Wanted, a travelling companion. In Martinus Nijhoff's great 1930s poem Arvata, the narrator sets out to secretly follow his neighbour, a mysterious man named Arvata, on his route home from work one evening. He waits on the office steps where Arvata works, then tails him, stalking him like a spy, keeping his distance as Arvata stops and starts, following him into the barber's, then into a bar where he watches him drink alone, a restaurant, and finally on towards the station. Here's the beginning of the pursuit as the narrator waits for Arvata to emerge from work. A recent translation by David Colmer. Tonight, I'll be Arvata's shadow. 5:30 sounds and time expands. Protect me, keep me shadowy, unlit. Preserve me as I am, unseen, unheard. I watch him on the final flight of stairs. No mortal soul, no town, no glow of dusk exists for him. He hurriedly descends the sandstone steps between the two brass snakes, eyes fixed, it seems, on some remote horizon where constant bolts of lightning charge the sky. As the poem progresses, it becomes uncertain whether the narrator is trailing Arvata or being led by him. For nearly 300 lines, Nijhoff's poem, often described as the great Dutch poem of the 20th century, sustains all the atmosphere of a surreal film, jump cut and fractured, vivid and dreamlike. At every moment we feel anything could happen. And it does, not least as Arvata, the self-effacing office clerk, enters the restaurant. "What?" whispers someone. "Don't you know Arvata?" A man who climbed the steps up to the stage has asked Arvata if he'll take his place. "I speak," he says, "for everybody here. A great artiste is present in our midst." Silence descends. A billiard player stops his game mid-break. Upstairs, the eager guests move forward to the balustrade and wait. Above us all, the ceiling fan is turning. Arvata then stands up and sings his song. And Arvata, the quiet accountant, stands to sing, cabaret style, a full Petrarch sonnet, a song of love and loss, to wild applause and a shower of party streamers. For readers and scholars, ever since the poem first appeared, the question has been who, in Martinus Nijhoff's imagination, was Arvata? Who was he following as he wrote the poem? In a 1935 lecture, Poetry in a Period of Crisis, translated here by James Holmes, Nijhoff said he wanted to create in Arvata a character who might stand for the times. Arvata, he explained, was to be an arbitrary individual with whom I had no personal ties. Arvata had to be the name for one person, but he was to remain abstraction and multitude. I wonder, too, whether the mysterious Arvata might not also be that figure many poets will recognise, the character who, when you sit down to write a certain kind of poem, you find is already there, waiting for you, arrived in some way ahead of you. As a writer working on this kind of exploratory poem, opening doors onto passageways and scenes in your head, working by discovery rather than intention, the mind moves through association to invention. And simultaneous with what you're inventing is the question of who you are inventing. So, in Nyhoff's poem, there is not one stranger, the mysterious Avatar himself, but two, for the unnamed narrator is also a character by whom we are puzzled, with whom we grow more and more engaged. So who is that narrating Nyhoff's poem, or any poem even? Who is that speaking? At its best, it's the voice that emerges in the writing of the poem, like a brushing touch of the more fully invented narrative voice in fiction. Anyone who's ever judged anonymous poetry competitions knows how the best poems fly free on the engines of their own action, independent, off the leash, speaking not with the my voice, so ardently wished for by apprentice writers, but with its own voice, the voice of the poem. John Keats saw it as a central requirement for the poet to inform some other body. A poet is the most unpoetical of anything in existence because he has no identity, Keats wrote, because he is continually informing and filling some other body. The Greek origins of the word ecstasy contain what's perhaps the related idea of standing outside oneself. And this may be too what poet Sean O'Brien was referring to when he suggested, "When I'm writing a poem, I look at it and often feel like a stranger." Thinking just about my own experience recently, a poem I was trying to write turned out to be an elegy for a son, though I have no son and haven't, as far as I know, ever wished I had one. The piece began as I was thinking about namesakes, people with the same name as your own, as my own. And as I wrote, I found, quite unexpectedly, a boy, already there, in a field. On finding him, the I in the poem became his parent, became his father, looking out from a train, addressing him. "I see your pale face lying in a passing field of frost, and like old Priam wonder, ah, did my son exist? Was he a dream? The rails hand us down the line. Boy in a field, you watch me pass, but do not wave. Can it be, if I chose, I could be fearless, could be brave?" It isn't that I don't want to take responsibility for the I in the poem. But as Rimbaud wrote in a letter in 1871, it's not my fault. It's not correct to say, "I think." One should say, "I am being thought." I is another. Je est un autre. T.S. Eliot, in his great essay, Tradition and the Individual Talent, describes the process of poetic development as a continual extinction of personality. And Nyhoff himself defined what he called a first-class writer as a writer who disappears in his work. Some poets have taken Keats's exhortation to fill some other body even further. The Belgian-born Henri Michaux found an unforgettable, surreal alter ego in what he described as his homme de plume, whom he named Plume, a central figure of his early collections. American poet John Berryman's Dream Songs give us Henry, an ostensible alter ego figure. Henry, as Berryman explained, is a character who, like himself, has suffered an irreversible loss and talks about himself sometimes in the first person, sometimes in the third, sometimes even in the second. "Henry does resemble me," Berryman said, "and I resemble Henry. But on the other hand, I am not Henry. I pay income tax. Henry pays no income tax." More dramatically, in a very different engagement with Keats's idea, Portuguese poet Fernando Pessoa invented several fully blown alternative poetic personae, poets with their own names, their own distinctive styles and personalities. This is what Pessoa said about others and the idea of the other. "The presence of another person derails my thoughts. I dream of the other's presence with a strange absent-mindedness that no amount of my analytical scrutiny can define." Thinking again about Nyhoff's haunting narrative, Throughout his strangely obsessive pursuit, the poem's narrator deliberately keeps his distance from Arvater, assiduously one step removed. Speaking of his relation as writer to the figure of Arvater, Nyhoff said, "At any cost, I had to avoid coming into contact with him. For that is when the weaknesses begin. And thinking about him, I noticed that even before I had given him a name, I had already begun transferring a great deal of myself into him. No, he must remain a silhouette. At the outside, he might be a travelling companion." So who are these dream guides, these travelling companions? Who are the figures writers chase down corridors like a receding lantern that stops and starts, keeping our distance, piggybacking on their power and energy? How much do we really want to catch up with them? We don't want to lose sight of them, yet are bound to, like the medieval dream narrator who wakes always just on the brink of understanding. Here's Nyhoff from that 1935 lecture. How can poetry make the world habitable once more? The world is a hell, a desert for whoever dares open his eyes. The pursuit of Arvater and the love I developed for him made the desert habitable, or at least travellable for me. The journey began in his shadow, but the love did not degenerate into attachment. Rather, it gave me the strength to continue the journey. Near the end of Nyhoff's poem, Arvater turns for the first and only time toward the narrator and looks him in the eye. Again, in David Colmer's excellent translation here. "I do my best to match my steps to his, so he won't hear that he is being followed." Arvater, who has slowed and stopped, turns back and studies me as if he knows my face. I see a look in his eyes that seems to ask, "Where from? A tram? A theatre intermission?" Arvater stays. I carry on and dash as if I've seen the train I hope to catch.
That was Jane Draycott, recorded by Julia Copus. You can find out more about Jane on her website at www.janedraycott.org.uk. That's Draycott with two T's. Next, here's Miranda France on finding your voice as a writer.
Just as a journey of 1,000 miles starts with a step, so must our 80,000 word book start with a sentence. But what sentence to choose when the options are infinite? It would be unbearably precious, even for us writerly types, to start expending too much anguish over just one word or one line. But it is true that setting off with the right first sentence can make everything that follows much easier. Perhaps it's what our mothers meant when they told us to put our best foot forward. Or in the words of one of my favourite authors, Nobel Prize winner Gabriel Garcia Marquez, "One of the most difficult things is the first paragraph. I have spent many months on a first paragraph, and once I get it, the rest just comes out very easily." In the first paragraph, you solve most of the problems with your book. The theme is defined, the style, the tone. The theme, the style, and the tone. If you've thought of a story or a set of characters, you may already be clear about the theme of your novel. Style and tone are something different, something we might also call voice. And voice is a key element in literary fiction, and in many novels, from Mrs. Dalloway to The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, it is the most important element. Listen to Clarissa Dalloway considering her attitude to life. She felt very young, at the same time unspeakably aged. She sliced like a knife through everything, at the same time was outside looking on. She had a perpetual sense, as she watched the taxicabs, of being out, far out to the sea and alone. She always had the feeling that it was very, very dangerous to live even one day. So much repetition, contradiction, and mixed imagery. The writer of non-fiction can't get away with such a poetic stance. He or she has to play with a straight bat or risk alienating readers who want an event or an idea clearly explained. A lucid representation of the facts with minimal spin. Photographic, you might say, whereas a novel is more like a painting than a photograph. Not many novelists, though there are some, want their treatment of a story to be so transparent that you don't even notice their presence. Like artists, novelists hope to show you something, but they want the way they show it to be part of the experience. In a really good novel, substance and style work together to show the reader something new about life. That's why the death of the novel, though regularly proclaimed, is always bound to be exaggerated. There may be only so many stories, and perhaps there are only a certain number of personality types in the world, but there are as many ways of telling stories and describing people as there are human beings able to put pen to paper. I actually do believe that everyone has a book in them, from cab drivers to socialites, farmers to shop assistants. It's getting the book out and onto paper that is so devilishly hard. In fiction, a distinctive voice is a way to get attention in a world that can feel very hostile to new writers. It's also a way to win readers' loyalty. It's the reason why we open a new book by a favourite author with an excitement and anticipation reminiscent of childhood. It's why readers will sometimes approach writers as if they were friends. It means that you can pick up a novel by, say, Anne Enright or Ian McEwan and immediately feel yourself in the presence of somebody familiar. For a writer like Martin Amis, it's practically the whole reason for writing. In fact, Amis has spoken about the danger of a voice being so dominating that every sentence carries its author's logo. We have to be careful not to let style entirely override substance. We need to be wary, too, of the editors who are on the lookout for a unique voice. Yes, it may be a way to get attention, but it can prove difficult to sustain on subsequent books. Better to find a style that works for you and that you like, rather than one that will buy you publicity. So, how do you find your voice? Where do you look for it? I don't think you can successfully mimic another writer, not for long anyway. Garcia Marquez has hundreds of imitators, but there is something hollow at the core of their writing. I think you need to cultivate a style of writing that feels comfortable and is close to your own personality. And that may take time and practice to identify, because we don't always know ourselves and our strengths as well as we think we do. As a teenager, I hoped to be a novelist and imagined myself writing very important works, and I feel work is definitely the right word here, about, well, you know, life and death and what it all means. You may have been the same when you were a teenager. It's the prerogative of youth to be pompous. Luckily, I had friends who set me straight. When I lived abroad in my 20s, some of them said they loved my letters because they were funny as well as informative. Funny? That hadn't really been what I had in mind, but when I started writing my first book, Bad Times in Buenos Aires, I was surprised to find humour sneaking in where it was least expected, and least welcome in a way, because there's nothing funny about people living in times of tyranny and dictatorship. Then again, anyone who has lived in a difficult place or through a difficult time knows that humour thrives in the dark. Bad Times was a travel book, but with elements of a novel, and with a voice, it turned out, that was mine. It was exhilarating to recognise that and to feel for the first time in my life that I could express ideas in my own way and describe places and people as I saw them, without deferring to a teacher or a newspaper editor. I discovered that I could use it to play with people's expectations. I could seem to be going in one direction with an earnest line of thought, then sharply pull out the rug beneath my imagined reader, subverting conventions with humour. The thing is, I hate to feel I'm trespassing on my reader's time or patience. I like to entice them into staying the course. It was writing about things in a lively way for my friends and family that helped me find my voice. People don't write many letters anymore, sadly. But there is still some way you can try out your voice on a sympathetic ear. I'm not talking about friends, lovers, or writers' groups, though I'm sure they all have their uses. I'm talking about a diary, a safe place to try out ideas and pieces of description in the knowledge that they won't be met by a baffled silence or one of those short, harsh laughs that instantly rob the would-be writer of all her confidence. A diary can't raise its eyebrows, it can't tell you your dreams of writing are a ridiculous fantasy. It can look blank, I suppose, but only until you fill its pages up with ideas. There's that man you saw on the tube whose nose seemed to point in several directions at once, or the woman who leaned forward as she walked, caught in some dangerous game with gravity. These are details, figments, nothing I'd bother to write home about. As ideas, they're still too flimsy to look at in print. But my diary is the equivalent of an artist's sketchbook, a place for thumbnail portraits, many of which will never go any further. Of course, a writer's notebook serves the same purpose, and I agree with all those people who say you should take one everywhere and even have it by the bedside. The trouble is that it's so easy to forget, and rarely at hand when you need it, say in the middle of a Zumba class, or if you're struck by a revelation in the bath, which is where revelations generally strike me. Besides, I think there may be a useful purpose in having to wait until the end of the day to write something down. That poor man's nose, for example. I find it hard to think of words to describe its texture, the incongruity of it appearing to point one way and another at the same time. I don't know how to get that across in a few words, and believe me, my failure in this respect matters a lot to me. I'll still be trying to puzzle it out at parents' evening, or in the middle of Pilates. I often gather up several images during the course of the day, say the man's nose, or a woman who deliberately laughs too loud, and a person who rubs his chin when he's nervous. During the day, I'll periodically have to say to myself, nose, chin, laugh, nose, chin, laugh. There's always the danger of losing one of them, and I know that I've mislaid body parts all over London while waiting to commit them to paper. My diary can't go everywhere with me because it would be so absolutely awful to lose it and find myself exposed. So if I'm really worried about losing an idea, I write it on whatever comes to hand and stick it in my bag. Much later I'll find them, these bus tickets, check stubs, business cards and telephone bills, bearing cryptic messages like, looks like a stackable toy, or hair sticks out straight from head like a pyramid, or knobbly old piece of ginger. And then begins the business of deciphering. Ah yes, I think to myself, that knobbly old piece of ginger is the nose I saw last month on the tube. And bit by bit it all begins to make a strange kind of sense. As a system it's certainly not perfect, but have you ever met a perfect writer?
That was Miranda France, recorded by Carol Angier. You can find out more about Miranda on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 21, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 22, the novelist Jonathan Buckley speaks with James McConaughey about formerly adventurous fiction, the current situation of writers, and the sheer difficulty of writing. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.